Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
You know, you could probably judge the health of one of those companies by, you know, going into it and seeing whether people are laughing in meetings or laughing with each other. Because I just think if that's not happening, then there probably is, you know, some problem with the culture.
Welcome to the Humorology Podcast with me, Paul Barros, and my glittering lineup of guests from the worlds of business, sport and entertainment, who are going to share their wisdom and their use of humour with you. Humorology is the study of how humour can dramatically improve your business and your life. Humorology puts the fun into business fundamentals, increases the value of your laughing stock, and puts a punchline back into your bottom line. Please remember to like, subscribe and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. My guest on this edition of the Humorology Podcast is a writer, director and producer for award-winning series and scintillating stories on the silver screen. His hit sitcom series, Drop the Dead Donkey, which he co-wrote and produced with Andy Hamilton, won a BAFTA for Best Comedy Series as well as a British Comedy Award. He continued his sitcom success with his second award-winning series, Outnumbered, which ran for 5 series and a special on BBC One. He then carried his comedic career to the silver screen with the award-winning film What We Did on Our Holiday, starring David Tennant, Rosamund Pike and Billy Connolly. However, comedy is not his only quality, having written and directed the romantic drama The Sleeping Dictionary, starring Hugh Dancy and Jessica Alba. His work on the screen shimmers with sophisticated silliness that leaves audiences in stitches whilst exploring the important issues of family, politics, love and life. Guy Jenkin, welcome to the Humorology Podcast.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
It's an absolute great pleasure to have you here, and what a career you've had. But I'd like to go back to the start. The Jesuits say, give me a child of 7 and I will give you the man. How was the young 7-year-old Guy Jenkin? Was he comedic? Was he funny? Was he inclined that way?
Oh, I don't know. Well, we're starting with the Jesuits. That is very highfalutin. I don't know. I think I wanted to be a writer from quite an early age. I hadn't quite worked out what I wanted to write. I suppose, you know, humour was always important in my family. So it's probably sets you off in the right direction. We didn't have a television till I was quite a bit older, so I wasn't watching the sort of great comedies when I was very young. But I did. I probably my comedy came from those children's books. You know, those very traditional ones like Just William and things like that, which are in fact very funny.
So, was anybody in your family funny? Was funny valued?
Well, I don't know. Nobody was a comedian, but I think that my family valued humour as a way of expressing ourselves. And I think always with families, the best moments that you remember are when everyone has a laugh about something. Often something that would never translate to the screen because it's so silly or so personal. Those sort of running jokes in families that make no sense to outsiders, but kind of unite the family. So I think there was always that.
And was it always very verbal humour? Or was it silly humour? What do you remember?
I mean, we weren't a sort of wisecracking family at all. Quite serious in most of the time in some ways. I mean, I was an only child, so I didn't have that outlet of a brother or sister where we could share humour. So I think it was more when I got school friends who, and they're often, it's what you laugh at that unites you.
Absolutely. Well, you've built a very successful career using comedy. Do you think that you can be a truly good communicator without understanding humour?
Can you be a good communicator without understanding humour? I suppose it's possible. Some people are excellent communicators and aren't funny. But it probably limits. If you're a communicator, like a politician or somebody who's just giving a message, then I don't suppose you need it. But I think if at a personal level, if you're in work, if you're trying to communicate with people around you, then I think you certainly lose a lot if you don't have humour.
I would say, and maybe you would agree or not, I don't know, that the difference between a good speaker or a good communicator and a great speaker is that essence of humour. Would you agree with that?
I think it certainly elevates anybody as a speaker. In the world of politics, a lot of the things that are remembered are not the sort of great phrases, but the wit of politicians. Calvin Coolidge is dead, how do they tell? Or just the insults, to be quite honest. I think you lose something if you have no sense of humour as a communicator.
I think we've had Alistair Campbell on the podcast, and we've also had William Hague. And Alistair Campbell said that actually the only thing that really scared Tony Blair was William Hague's humour at Prime Minister's questions, because he could cut him to the quick with his humour. And so that was the thing that elevated William Hague. Having said that, he didn't win power ultimately, did he? So.
Well, I think the jokes definitely lost at that point. I mean, I don't ever remember Tony Blair being funny. He was certainly very earnest. But that's clearly a case of where it didn't work.
But talking about politics, and we won't go into anybody's politics, but we do have a prime minister at the moment in Boris Johnson who seems to be boosted by being perceived, at least, as humorous and not serious. And do you think that's as a result of people being sort of like fed up with humour being taken out of politics?
Possibly. I mean, there is that desire for supposed authenticity, which often I think is extremely manicured and well prepared authenticity.
If you can fake that, you can get away with anything.
If you can fake authenticity, then you've got a long career in politics ahead of you. Yes, it does. Yeah, I mean, and if you compare him to May before him, who certainly showed no signs of having any sense of humour, and seemed, you know, as you said about Tony Blair, seemed kind of scared by humour, didn't know what to do. So maybe it is a reaction against those kind of politicians.
What makes you laugh, Guy?
Fleabag and This Country and There She Goes and virtually anybody falling over. Always find that very funny. In life, I suppose it's just those moments with friends where a joke continues. You know, not sort of, it's not like a story or a joke, but just something where somebody's funny and then somebody gets on board with that and it just keeps rolling. I think those are often the moments that I look back on as having really, really enjoyed.
Yeah, there's something about sharing laughter with people you know really well, isn't there? That you can just say a word and it anchors you back to the state of fun and laughter. I think that's very true. Tell me a true funny story about something that's happened to you.
Well, you mentioned the film, What We Did on Our Holiday. I mean, I arrived back in Glasgow on a sort of late night train, and they got a minicab for me, and I was going to get in the back, but I ended up getting in the front of this cab. It was about an hour's drive to where we were filming. And I almost instantly fell asleep. And then I was woken up by this noise, and I realized it was the driver snoring that had woken me up. And we were just approaching a corner in this wooded road. So I kind of grabbed the wheel. We went around this corner. This isn't really a funny story, is it? Sorry. So he shook himself awake, very apologetic. And obviously we talked a great deal. I just fired questions at him nonstop for the remaining half hour of the drive. I mean, what was very strange was that Andy Hamilton and I had written in the film already a scene where everybody in the family falls asleep, and the little girl who's sitting in the front of the car has taken the steering wheel and is the only one awake steering them down a motorway. So rather than copying real life, real life copied the film. But
My word. Tragedy plus time equals comedy there, really, isn't it?
Yes, yeah, that is true. Well, near tragedy, certainly.
Well, yeah. Gosh, did the guy recognise that he'd fallen asleep?
No, he was very thankful, I think, if I got in the back, I don't know what would have happened. And if he hadn't snored, I don't know what would have happened. It's certainly the moment of being awoken by somebody snoring is very memorable.
I'm sure it is. Gosh.
There was another moment on that film, which was, it sounds like a nightmare. It was one of the most enjoyable experiences of my life. It was wonderful. But we'd hired a helicopter to just do a day's worth of filming in the north of Scotland, and we've got various units in different places ready to roll when the helicopter arrived. And so myself and the first AD arrived to meet the helicopter, and there was a guy with a Russian accent who was a pilot who came out of the helicopter, and his first words to us were, "We are so fucked." And then the cameraman, the weather was so bad, the thunderstorms, and the cameraman came out and his hand was shaking visibly as he shook hands with us. And we thought afterwards they must have been sort of struck by lightning on the way over or something, because clearly something had happened. But from then on, sort of then going up in this helicopter, they said, well, we'll just do a little bit. The first AD told someone to say goodbye to his wife. And we went round with this guy who was clearly completely psyched by something. The other words I remember from him is, we are flying over the sea. We have no life jackets. This is so illegal.
So and I you still got in the helicopter?
Well, people were waiting, you know. I make this film sound like it was some sort of nightmare near-death experience, where most of it was just sitting on a beach waiting for the, you know, waiting to get ready with Billy Connolly telling us wonderful stories. So in fact, as I say, and the three young children in it who were lovely, and so it was actually a very good experience.
Well, I'm fascinated because you've worked so much with young children, you've had so much success. I mean, I'm thinking particularly of Outnumbered and obviously the film. The children don't have life experiences of the adults and different perspectives, etc. How can children be funny without resorting to just telling grown-up jokes? And what lessons can we learn from the humour of children? Is it simpler, more honest, more direct?
Well, I know Samantha Bond, who played the auntie in Outnumbered, was acting with Ramona Marquez, who plays the little girl in that. And she said sort of, well, that this is what she doing, what Ramona is doing is true acting, because she is just being absolutely in the moment, which is what all other actors aspire to. I mean, it varies according to the age of the children, how conscious they are of what they're doing, I think. But when they're younger, I think it's, well, partly we didn't ever get them to learn lines in advance and things like that. So they're just really just being themselves. You know, in some ways, filming was the least exciting part of their day. You know, they'd go off upstairs and they had a very, where they had a sort of tutor who made it great fun, and then they'd just be interrupted every now and again by, you know, somebody annoyingly coming them, telling them they had to go downstairs and film for 45 minutes. So I think it is just them genuinely being themselves.
But how do you set that up in terms of, I mean, presumably it's largely about the casting and getting the right children in place. I mean, I used to guest with the Comedy Store Players, and like with improvising, that's a game and everyone's trained to follow the lead. But how does it work when something is partly scripted and partly improvised?
I think it's partly that you create a situation where you sort of take away all the sort of things that are annoying about filming to children. No makeup. We didn't have a first, you know, who's sort of shouting action. We just had the cameras rolling when they came onto set. We didn't tell them to stand anywhere in particular. We had a great lighting director who would just light an area so they could just wander around and just be themselves. And of course, it also takes very, you know, actors who are, well, both very skilled and very generous playing with them. in that Claire and Hugh in Outnumbered, you know, they would the first setup would always be two cameras on the children, or a camera on the child and them, and on the child, and where they would just be kind of encouraging the child to say what they felt comfortable, you know, to get the lines we needed out, but or just to sort of run off in some direction if that worked. And then because of the children's hours, they then had the hell of doing their half with Andy or me squatting down in a cramped position, doing an impersonation of a 4-year-old or a 6-year-old. You know, they must take a lot of credit for that, I think.
Oh, no. Well, I mean, it was just fabulous. And it's lovely to hear about how, but you actually have to allow them to play, because the connection with humorology is kind of like, say, an executive tells a joke and expects a certain response that doesn't get that response. Where does he go with that? Is there a way to plan for that so our listeners can sort of take something away from it?
A friend of mine in a marketing meeting with a Zoom meeting with Amazon, and there are about 50 people literally on the Amazon side of it. So his opening remark was, "So who's delivering all the parcels today?" which I find very funny, but apparently went down like a lead balloon. So obviously you have to choose your audience for the ice-breaking comment. That it would have worked on me. I don't know. It's generally good to be able to be funny, except you just occasionally come up with against people who at least in that situation don't have a sense of humour.
Yeah, you work in a very creative medium, and I think, you know, most companies need to be creative. Most people, whatever they're doing, need to be creative. How important is a sense of play in creativity?
I think that is very important. You know, you could probably judge the health of a one of those companies by, you know, going into it and seeing whether people are laughing in meetings, are laughing with each other. Because I just think if that's not happening, then there probably is, you know, some problem with the culture. So, just sort of feeling unfettered when you're, you know, working towards an idea, or being able to go off on some tangent that is funny and then actually may lead somewhere. I think, and it also just makes people want to come into work much more, I think. So, I agree that. I think that really is very important.
Is everyone potentially funny, or are there some people who just, because you just mentioned that, you know, that people didn't get that joke and got offended or whatever, and you go, is there a potential, or is it a gift given to the few?
I don't think the few. I mean, you do find people who just don't have a sense of humour, which makes it very difficult, I think. You know, you just see, you know, occasionally around a table or something, you'll see everybody laughing and you just see somebody kind of staring, thinking, why is that funny?
Well, yeah, I suppose it's good, but I think if you're not funny, I think you have to learn how to be a good audience, because then you are part of that.
Well, I suppose it depends if you're not. I mean, a lot of people aren't funny, but if you don't find anything funny, then you can't even be a good audience. So I think that is tricky. But I suppose kind of like-minded people tend to gather together. So, you know, hopefully in workplaces, then there is a sort of I don't know, I think they often take their quality from whoever's the, if, you know, if there's one person in charge, they often set that tone. So if that person can be funny and relaxed, then it kind of allows the business to be like that. And probably also people sort of hire people who are a bit like them. So I think you get these companies where there's a very positive culture of comedy. I mean, certainly Hattrick, where I do the majority of my work, is very like that.
Is that set by the leaders? Obviously, I know Jimmy Mulville, who runs Hattrick, and you work with Jimmy, and you also, you know, work with Andy Hamilton. Are you setting the tone for everything on sets and in meetings and everything? And is leadership important in creating that tone?
Well, in Hattrick, it's Jimmy, because, you know, we've got an office there, but we're not officially part of Hattrick in any way. So I think that tone comes very much from him. You know, and the other kind of senior leaders there. But yeah, I think on set, it certainly helps. I suppose you've got to kind of know, it depends a bit on the actors that you're working with. You know, sometimes there are those actors who just really want to get into a zone before they act, particularly if it's a more serious scene, and then you don't want to break that. But generally, the point where you and someone can have a laugh about something is the point where you kind of create a relationship and it moves on from there.
I remember you and I both knew William G. Stewart, and I remember when I was very young going on sets with him. In fact, I went to Frost Live from London, and I was there in the afternoon, and I was like sort of, you know, 16 years old, and I went, "Bill, you know everybody's name." And he looked at me and he went, "Paul, that's the job. The job is to know everybody's name and keep everybody happy. That's what a producer should be doing." And I remember that the sparks would walk by and he'd go, "All right, Sammy, how you doing?" And everything, "All right, Billy boy," you know, and they'd have banter and they would do that. But there was a purpose to it, because especially in those days, as you remember, it was very highly unionized.
Yeah.
And if you needed two more shots at the end of the day, if you hadn't got the crew on side, they literally would just pull the plug and walk off. Whereas he had a rapport with everybody. And so when he needed anything, you know, he'd go up to Sammy and say, "Sammy, we need an extra half an hour for the boys. I'll see them right in the bar." And Sammy would go round and talk to everybody. So, I mean, for our listeners to take away, to create an atmosphere so that when something does go wrong, you have a connection through humour.
That simple thing, like knowing everybody's name, is really important. And, you know, I William G. Stewart was a producer and director on a couple of early things that I wrote. And so, you know, he's one of those people that you learn that from. I mean, you know, apart from the practical benefits, it's also just a much nicer working atmosphere if you know who people are and can talk to everybody. I think on set also that it kind of divides between those people who are in charge, who think that gives them an entitlement, and those in charge who thinks it makes them have a sort of duty. And things work much better with the latter people. And you find that with leading actors as well. You know, there are people who you know, feel that because they're the lead in something, they will they have a sort of responsibility to set a tone, to know people, to, you know, have everybody round the pub afterwards. And they, you know, they're obviously a magnificent asset to a production. I think in some cases it comes from people who were actors who were sort of touring in stage productions for a long time, because I think they're that culture. Generally, I'm sure there are exceptions, but generally that the stars, I think, were expected to sort of set the tone there.
Given that you've got so many actors you can choose from, and, you know, in business there are so many people we can choose from, surely you are always going to make a choice of somebody who creates that brilliant atmosphere. You've got two great actors. You're going to...
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Choose the one who creates the best atmosphere on set, aren't you?
Well, that's very important, I think. I think that there is sometimes a misunderstanding about sort of genius, that to be a genius, you've got to be a complete bastard, you know, and, you know, you've got to be troubled and therefore annoying. And for every, you know, great actor who is like that, there are several others who are equally talented, but a great pleasure to work with. And so, yeah, I mean, there's a kind of, on casting lists, many people have a sort of a sort of code of LTS that goes against some names, which is life's too short. So there are actors who you just get warned off, a very small minority. I mean, I don't think I've ever worked with anybody who's been a pain in the ass. You know, generally it's just, you know, it is a pleasure. But I think that definitely that notion that to be good you have to be difficult is very wrong. I worked with somebody who had moved from being a personal assistant in Hollywood to working in post-production in sound, and they said the final straw was they were a personal assistant to a big Hollywood actor. and he asked for a glass of iced water, and they brought it to him. And he said, no, I want it without condensation. And they thought, yeah, well, I can bring water, but I can't reverse the laws of physics here. And I think that had just been the thing that sort of pushed them over.
Tip the balance and everything. I can't work with this. There's condensation on my glass. Who do I see? Who do you have to fuck in this town to get no condensation in your ice water?
God.
That's brilliant. Everything. It's very Spinal Tap, isn't it?
You know the scene in
Spinal Tap in the dressing room where he has the big piece of meat and the small bread. And he's going, I can't work with this. I can't work with this, but I'll rise above it because I'm a professional. Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you one more story that was told to me from the set of a big epic film in that was filming in Britain. Where they had their sort of biggest day. They had 2,000 supporting artists waiting to go. They had special effects. And then the leading actor was quite slow coming onto set. And then eventually he arrived, but he arrived with his guitar and said, before we go, I'd like to play some songs to this audience. So he gathered all the crew and cast around him and was playing Bob Dylan songs at costs of tens of thousands of pounds per hour. It must be some kind of power play, mustn't it? It must be a sort of, I can do this. But those are the people you don't want to work with.
Yeah. Well, it is. I mean, psychologically speaking, that is just a power play, isn't it? I've got an audience and I'm going to know, and I'm going to hold everybody else up. When I started off in the business by doing walk-ons and extras and work just to get experience and get money when I was very young. And I soon worked out that the most important person on the set wasn't always the person you thought it was. It wasn't always the producer and it wasn't all the thing. Because if you'd pissed off, I remember sitting in makeup once on the last days of Pompeii with where I played Ernest Borgnine's slave. And I'm sitting there and the second AD ran into the truck where we were being made up and went, hurry up, we're going to think. And as soon as he closed the door, the makeup people put their stuff down and went, who wants a cup of tea? Deliberately to do it because they'd been, you know, the power play had gone the wrong way. So you have to be very careful on that, playing those games, because otherwise they will trip you up. So I love the LTS comment of a life's too short, which leads me to what would the world be like without humour?
Considerably more miserable than it is already, probably. Sorry, that sounds very bleak.
No, it's fine.
Well, I don't know. We wouldn't know about it, so we wouldn't miss it, I suppose.
Well, yeah. Then,
I'd be out of a job for a start.
Well, that is quite bleak. Do you find yourself funny, Guy?
I find what I write funny. I do. Before lockdown, I did tend to write in cafes. Partly because I just kind of like being out in the world, but I think also because you can't, once you're there, you can't go and divert yourself by turning on the telly or going off and doing some gardening or something. But I realised occasionally, if I've written something that I find funny, laugh to myself. But then I realised I must be that man in the corner of the cafe, sitting there scribbling and occasionally chuckling, although nobody else was there. probably also occasionally kind of mouthing the lines I was writing. So I'm sure the other people there must have thought there was someone with mental health issues in the corner.
Care in the community.
Care in the community. Well, yeah, I suppose it, yes. I noticed they sometimes started giving me free coffee, so they obviously felt sorry for them. The poor old codger.
So it's working. But you've just told an anecdote, which is laughing at yourself. So how important do you think it is, well, for good mental health, for resilience, and to laugh at yourself?
You don't want to be the only one not laughing at you, do you? It's, well, no, clearly it is very important to be able to do that, particularly if you have children, I find, because if you don't, they certainly will.
They certainly will, Guy.
They're very, very healthy in that respect. They kind of, you know, at keeping you centred, as they would say now.
Well, yeah, or taking you down off your imagined pedestal. Strange how they can do that. So if I asked you to write a business case for humour, what would you include in it?
A business case for humour? Well, at its simplest, I think that an office where there's a lot of humour, everybody's happier, and people who are happier probably work better. So I think I would boil it down to that. I mean, there's obviously other things, but I think that's probably the most important thing.
I think it is the most important thing. And you've just expressed the return on investment, which is people are going to work better when they're happier. And they're going to be more willing to actually, you know, do things for you when they do that. So I think it's a great thing. And what else is a return on investment for keeping? Just thinking in terms of a set, what's your return on investment for keeping a good atmosphere and humour at the forefront?
Well, people work better, you know. If people are just sort of trudging through the day, then, you know, you'll make mistakes. Actors, you know, it's tough kind of pulling yourself up to give a performance on cue, you know, 6 days a week, 10 hours a day. So, you know, humour can't do that alone. But certainly if it's somewhere that you can have a laugh and look forward to going into in the mornings, then it's going to make a difference.
So you think there's a correlation between if the set is miserable or if the office is miserable, that actually it has a knock-on effect to how things get done, how quickly, how efficiently things get done?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we know ourselves. We're going to do a much better job if we're feeling cheerful that day or cheerful about it than if we're not. You know, filling in paperwork, it's very hard to feel cheerful about. Whereas if you're doing something that you're sort of vaguely enjoy, then that's going to work better.
Have you ever taken a joke too far or crossed the line?
I'm sure I must have.
You just don't want to admit it, do you?
Well, I did do something once that certainly probably didn't really help some of the relationships I was in. When I was, I think I was 29, I was working for Spitting Image. And they had a sort of, they got rid of the older writers. At 29, I was an older writer. I mean, God knows what I am now. I've been, that was the first time I was over the hill. I've kind of come crawling stubbornly back many times from then. But they wanted younger writers. There was a shortage of female writers. And so those were the days when you just sort of posted material off. So a 14-year-old schoolgirl called Sarah Yellup started posting material in. And that was me. So, and she did very, very well. One of the somebody wrote in the New Musical Express, it's a sad reflection on the tired old British comedy writers that the best sketch this week was written by a 14-year-old schoolgirl. She got her own credit one week. She was doing brilliantly. But I eventually told them, and I don't think that probably, certainly temporarily anyway, that didn't help my relationship with a few people.
Because they felt that you they'd been conned, basically.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair to them, I suppose it showed that their sort of vetting of material sent in was very good. Probably impersonating a 14-year-old female now would be frowned upon, but it was. I think what that proves is that people, when you're looking for something, you find it. So, but, they were looking for this. Probably why a lot of scientific experiments have gone wrong, because you're looking for something and you find a way of finding it. So.
Yes, you think, well, it's funny because Ronnie Barker used to have a pen name, didn't he? That he used to write in as, I can't remember the name he had. But
Gerald
Wiley? Something. Yes, I think it was.
I think something like that, anyway.
And but he did it so he wouldn't be judged on those terms. Yeah. In business, is it survival of the fittest or survival of the funniest?
I know you want me to say the funniest, but...
I don't, actually. I don't care.
No, I mean, are Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos known for their fantastic senses of humour or their killer instinct? We've spoken about how it's very important to set a tone, but... I suspect that the killer in businessmen is probably more effective in the long run than the funny.
Yeah, I think it depends, doesn't it, on the circumstances somewhat, but I think ultimately you're right, the killer is going to win out, which upsets me slightly from a humorology perspective.
Well, maybe Jeff Bezos is actually, in real life is just killingly funny, and we just don't know that.
Well, you're never going to find out now you've pissed off those people from Amazon.
Not me.
You told the story.
Oh, okay. Fair enough.
Oh, no, you're joking. We now come to the part of our show, Guy, called Quickfire Questions.
Quickfire questions.
Who's the funniest business person you've met? Now, obviously, you work in the television business, so it can be that business or it can be any person you've met who's not a comedian.
Not a comedian? Oh, well, that was going to be my answer.
Go on then. Well, you can be a comedian then.
No, I mean, I was just going to say Billy Connolly. Because, I mean, I'd always hugely admired him as a comedian. And then in person, he was just a great teller of stories. You know, he would tell you this story and he'd have you kind of roaring. And then you go back and tell it to somebody else and they go, yeah, that's quite funny. And so you realise it was him. So as a kind of, because I, you know, as a sort of acid as an acid test. I think that was, you know, like a scientific experiment that proves that he's fantastically funny.
Genius is a word that's too often bandied around, but we are talking real genius when we think, because his ability to A, tell stories, but tell them and bring them to life. And he has that extraordinary knack of make laughing it in. And from a psychological perspective, I would say what he's doing is, there's a saying in psychology that if you want anybody to go into any state, you have to go into that state first. He goes into such a state of fun that you enter that state with him and get carried along with it. Is that what you're saying about the way he is?
It may be that. I can't analyze what makes him funny, but I think that's an element of it, certainly. Yeah, and I mean, different comedians have different techniques, don't they? You know, there are those who carry you along with them, and there's those who are sort of funnier than you, who you know, work that way. But no, I think you're probably right. I think that probably is a big element of it.
What book makes you laugh?
I tell you what, I'll pick Spike Milligan's World War II, autobiography, I suppose, because I think he was a writer that could make you laugh out loud on the page, which not a huge number of writers can do, you know, even good ones, even funny ones. But I also think that they're sort of as a document about what World War II was like, about what being there, you know, just as a sort of squaddy was like. They're a fantastic history resource that people should read, because he captures that. But he also is, as ever, killingly funny. I think the longest laugh I've ever heard was at the British Comedy Award, where they were giving him a lifetime award. I don't know if you know the moment. And he came up on stage and he looked quite sort of unwell and a little bit sort of shaky, and you sort of thought, oh dear, I hope he's all right. And very pretentiously, they got out a kind of roll of vellum and read out an accolade to him from Prince Charles. And there was a pause, and then he said, "Groveling little shit." And it was just, I mean, at that moment, it was just sort of that perfect pricking of pomposity.
Yes.
And I must have laughed for about 5 minutes. It just because of the, I don't know. It was one of the relatively few funny moments at the British Comedy Awards.
But the wonderful thing was there was that sharp intake of breath first of all, and then the room just exploded, didn't it? And it carried on the laugh.
It was very joyful, I thought. Yeah. Because also it was that sense of, oh, he has still got it. Because it is almost a fear that it's going to be one of those embarrassing moments, you know, you give somebody too late there, you know, and of course it wasn't.
No. Oh, no. Absolute genius again. What film makes you laugh, Guy?
I'm sure it would be a completely different one on a different day. I think today I'm going to say Midnight Run. Charles Grodin, De Niro. It's one of those sort of few films that escapes genre. It's like I mean, it's obviously a very good comedy. It's a brilliantly sort of character-based comedy of this odd couple, but also a bit of a thriller. You know, there's gunfights. There's a sort of serious undertone to it. But it certainly, it doesn't pale with watching it many times. His Girl Friday, I would say, on another day. It must have a script that's about four times as long as most modern scripts, because it just, the dialogue just crackles along at fantastic speed and they never stop talking. But it's great. Well,
Midnight Run, you share with Ainsley Harriott, chose that on this show as well.
Oh, that's interesting. There's a kind of small group of people who, when you say that to, they say, yes, that's a great film. If I ever meet Ainsley Harriott, I'll have something to talk about with him.
Well, we all live pretty close to each other, so I can arrange that whenever you like. We'll have breakfast together. What's not funny? Going to the other side of things, what is not funny?
Well, very little isn't funny. I mean, you know, Chris Morris made one of those fake news shows about paedophilia that unsurprisingly got attacked by lots and lots of people who hadn't seen it. And I thought, how can that be funny? But because it was about the reaction to it and the sort of overreaction of the press, and it was funny. So, you know, it to anybody who hasn't seen it will probably be horrified. But
no, you know. But they should look it up, because it was, I think it was on Brass Eye, wasn't it?
Brass Eye. It was a special edition of Brass Eye.
Yeah, Brass Eye. And it was about the way the press dealt with it, like you say, and it was heightening the awareness. And you're right, it was funny, but it's an inappropriate thing, supposedly, for comedy. But it worked. So, I mean, is there anything that makes you slightly uncomfortable in terms of comedy that you think, or do you think everything is fair game if it's in the right hands and it's done in the right way?
I think it's usually tone that makes me uncomfortable in a comedy, where somebody just seems to have being funny, not about something that you can't be funny about, but being funny about it in a way that makes you uncomfortable.
What word makes you laugh?
Oh, God. A very appropriate swear word can make me laugh. I think just on occasions, I mean, it's overused, but if somebody picks it just right, if there haven't been any, and then suddenly somebody comes out with one, then I think that is often very funny.
What sound makes you laugh?
Well, I do like slapstick. So I suppose the sound of people falling over in a funny way, I would admit to that. I do have a sort of weakness for those shows that collect video footage of things going wrong.
Would you? I know that you you were educated at Cambridge. So would you rather be considered clever or funny?
Probably funny. I mean, I suppose ideally you do want to be considered a bit of both, because you want it to be sort of clever humour rather than, you know, toilet humour. If you put a gun to my head, I'll go funny.
You do, but do you not think that most people you've met in your life who are funny are also clever? Do you have to be clever in order to be funny?
It helps, certainly.
Yeah.
I mean, there's people who are just have funny bones, I think, who don't know why they're funny, but are funny. And I suppose for that, you don't need to be clever. That's just a gift.
So, well, I'm intrigued by this because people I think have got funny bones would be people like Tommy Cooper or Eric Morecambe. But I would say that they were clever because they understood, you know, the rhythm of things that work. They understood that how important the physicality of it was. And it's just a different kind of clever, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, with them, I think that is the case. I suppose, but I'm thinking perhaps more people you come across or people you know. But I think, with them, yeah, they obviously are very clever in working out how to use it.
And finally, Guy, desert island gags. You can only take one joke with you to a desert island. What is it?
All right, I shall tell this one in honour of Barry Cryer, who was someone else who was very nice to us when we were all sort of young writers and took us to drinking dens that were open in the afternoon. But he knows more parrot jokes than most people know jokes. So I should go for the very trad. Somebody walks into a pub. A man walks into a pub with a hamster and a parrot, and there's a piano at the pub, and the hamster hops up onto the piano and starts to play, and he's like Rachmaninoff. It's magnificent. And then the parrot flies over, sits on top of the piano, and is singing, and the parrot, like Pavarotti, got amazing voice, brings the house down. And afterwards, the publican comes up to the guy and says, look, I'll buy either of those animals off you. He said, well, you can have the parrot for 50 quid. And somebody was watching this. You're mad. I mean, they're fantastically valuable. Why have you sold the parrot for 50 quid? And he says, well, the hamster's a ventriloquist. It's not the greatest joke in the world, but it came to mind.
It's a great gag and a great way to finish with a great talent. Thank you so much for being my guest today, Guy Jenkin. It's been a pleasure.
Well, thank you very much. I've enjoyed talking to you.
The Humorology Podcast was hosted by Paul Barros and produced by Simon Banks. Music by Steve Hayworth, creative direction by Les Hughes, and additional research by Helen Sykes. Please remember to subscribe, like, and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. This has been a Big Sky production.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.